From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1964 when the British futurist and science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke tried his hand at predicting our future. He spoke of bioengineering, a future in which humans engineered apes to be our servants. He spoke about the future of weaponry and conflict, and he predicted that the very nature of work would change. That was 1964. Clarke saw that within around 50 years, human beings would have a lot more control in where and how they worked, and it would fundamentally change our society. Let's listen to some of what he said in 1964.
Oh, I'm not thinking of the atom bomb and the next Stone Age. I'm thinking of the incredible breakthrough which has been made possible by developments in communications, particularly the transistor and, above all, the communication satellite. These things will make possible a world in which we can be in instant contact with each other, wherever we may be, where we can contact our friends anywhere on Earth, even if we don't know their actual physical location. It will be possible in that age, perhaps only 50 years from now, for a man to conduct his business from Tahiti or Bali just as well as he could from London. In fact, if it proves worthwhile, almost any executive skill, any administrative skill, even any physical skill, could be made independent of distance. I am perfectly serious when I suggest that one day we may have brain surgeons in Edinburgh operating on patients in New Zealand. When that time comes, the whole world will have shrunk to a point, and the traditional role of the city as a meeting place for man would have ceased to make any sense. In fact, men will no longer commute. They will communicate. They won't have to travel for business anymore. They'll only travel for pleasure. I only hope that when that day comes and when the city is abolished, the whole world isn't turned into one giant suburb.
All right, that was Arthur C. Clarke, 1964. Now, he's been right about so much of that. Here's a brand new headline from Georgetown University. Amazon is going back to the office every day, but can cities make a comeback after years of empty offices? The author there noted the following, quote, "In September, Amazon mandated its employees to return to the office 5 days a week. The move comes after several years of remote and hybrid work that has seen cities struggle to adapt. Empty office spaces have left once vibrant downtown areas with less foot traffic and economic activity. Amazon is reinforcing the importance of its headquarters location in Seattle and signaling that its mission to embrace and foster innovation is not a spatially distributed endeavor, but a socially dependent activity tied to a specific place." End quote. This would have made a number of politicians happy. Since the pandemic, a number of leaders have called on workers to go back to the office, saying that cities are in trouble with miles of empty office space. In New York City, for example, 200,000 people moved away from the city during the pandemic as jobs shifted online. Arthur C. Clarke would have said that you can't put this genie back in the bottle. The nature of work has changed, just as he predicted. One of our guests this hour has been working remotely for 8 years and says she will not go back to a non-remote job. But this is a rare case of bipartisan agreement. Governor Kathy Hochul called on workers to go back to their offices in 2022. She said, we can't afford so much empty office space. President Biden called on federal workers to go back to the office last fall. And Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser agreed, saying that remote workforces are stripping away the vibrancy of downtowns. Well, now the incoming Trump administration seems to agree as well. Vivek Ramaswamy and Elon Musk are working on this. Ramaswamy went on Tucker Carlson recently to say that he would dramatically slash the federal workforce. And one easy way to do it is to make workers go back to the office. That solves two problems, he says. It will help struggling cities, and it forces out lazy remote workers who don't actually do that much work anyway. He said, quote, they don't go to work. You don't even have to talk about being in a mass firing, a mass exodus. Just tell them they've got to come in to the office 5 days a week from 8 to 6. That would lead to a 25% thinning out of the federal bureaucracy right there, end quote. So will that work? Do threats work? The numbers are stark. 15% of Americans now work remotely. That's the highest number ever recorded. Axios reports that U.S. office vacancy rates are now just over 20% nationwide, also an all-time high. Some cities nearing 30% vacant. My guests this hour have a range of perspectives on the state of remote work, office use, and the landscape heading into 2025. Let me welcome in studio Patrick Dutton, a downtown developer and a real estate broker with Fortified and Dutton Properties. Welcome back. Nice to see you here.
Good to see you.
Welcome to Jen Long, who is, well, she's one of the people I talked about in that introduction, a senior content SEO manager at Zoom. Been working remotely for 8 years and apparently not going back, are you?
No, certainly not.
Welcome. Thank you for being here. George Conboy on the line with us, chairman of Brighton Securities, who is joining us remotely. Hello, George.
It seems appropriate, Evan.
I guess so. Do you have any remote workers, George? What's the disposition in Brighton Securities towards remote work?
We've got about a single digit percentage of our staff working remotely right now. One employee moved to another state a couple of years ago, and valuable employee. We retained her on staff, and she does a wonderful job remotely. And yours truly, ancient geezer of the staff, I work remotely a couple of times a year for several weeks, and it seems to work out just fine.
Okay, well, lots to discuss here. Let me just start with the story of Jen Long. Jen actually reached out a number of months ago and was just curious about, you know, the state of Rochester remote work. We keep seeing different headlines, Constellation, others, you know, some moving downtown, some moving away from downtown. For you, why Rochester? You're not from here. Why are you here?
Well, kind of one of the most amazing things about remote work is I moved here from Dallas, but since my job is remote, I could pretty much pick anywhere in the continental United States. I mean, I guess also Hawaii and Alaska, anywhere in the country that I wanted to move to. So I was able to do like a really in-depth search, and I happened to fall in love with Rochester. It's very quirky. It's very fun and weird. It reminds me a lot of like Austin and some of those very funky cities, just on a smaller scale, and it was perfect.
And can I ask, do you live in the city proper, or are you in a suburb?
I'm in Highland Park. So
Highland Park. And you've been in Rochester for how long now?
Almost about a year and a half.
Okay. No regrets moving from Texas to Rochester?
None.
No. And again, no family here?
Nope. All of my family's in Texas.
No romantic connection here?
Brought my boyfriend with me.
Okay, but you didn't come here for somebody else. You came here for you.
Yep.
By choice.
Yep.
Okay. And what has your employer said about this? I mean, they're used to you. You were working remotely before the pandemic anyway, yes?
Yes.
So no issue there at all?
None. I just changed time zones from Central to Eastern.
So what is it? What is your sense then, Jen, about the way that politicians are looking at this issue, whether it's Governor Hochul saying, we got to get people back in the cities. Joe Biden says that. President Biden says that. Vivek Ramaswamy says, we got to do that. And by the way, remote workers don't really want to go work anyway. You know, we'll light a fire under them. They're, a lot of them are lazy.
It's really funny because, I mean, you can be not working at home or not working in the office. There's plenty of people that go in and mess around on their phones or they start shopping online, but it appears like they're working because managers and executives can see someone in a chair. And it's an issue where a lot of managers and executives don't know how to properly measure productivity other than butts in seats. But I am more productive at home. I have narcolepsy, so I have to take something that gets me up in the morning. So I am way more productive in the morning. I usually start working at 7:30 or 8. I would not do that in an office. And since I work from home, I'm happy to take emails and chats and calls before and after hours and on the weekends. I usually work more than 40 hours a week. I usually eat my lunch at my desk. Like I'm working more. I would not do those things in an office because when I worked in Dallas, I lived 15 miles north in North Dallas, and I commuted to downtown. That was typically 45 minutes to an hour one way, so 2 hours a day, roughly, that I would lose just driving. So I'm definitely not staying late or answering anything after because I had to go through all of that just to get into the office.
Okay, so it's working for you. What about your peers? Do you have people in your age cohort who are just talking about wanting to go in this direction, or do you know a lot of people who've moved in remote directions?
I know people in both. I know people who prefer remote, people that like hybrid, and people who like working in the office. And I think that's the biggest thing is that these forced return to office or forced even remote or hybrid, it goes so much better if it's the employee's choice, because they're going to know the best way they work. If they want to work in an office, awesome. If they want to work remote, great. If they want hybrid, fantastic. But it should be up to them, not forcing someone.
I'm going to ask George and Patrick about this in a minute, but you touched on this. A lot of the hand-wringing that has been expressed, at least on this program, in the last decade, as remote work really has risen in popularity, is a concern that they can't monitor productivity, that you can't be as productive at home, and the bottom line is you've got to be able to be productive. You seem to think, look, if you're just measuring productivity by whether you see a physical person in a chair, you're not very good at measuring productivity. Is that fair?
Yeah.
And so is it about reimagining how we evaluate the quality of work?
I think we need to have a better way of actually measuring someone's impact in their role. Like, if you have a good idea of how impactful someone is at whatever job they do, then it's probably going to get to the point where, you know, even if they were in an office and they were to take an extra long lunch, it doesn't matter. They're being really productive. Like, they're getting things done. And I think tying it to hours, no person on earth is productive for 8 hours a day straight. It just doesn't happen. It's not realistic.
Okay. George Conboy, chairman of Brighton Securities. Is there any part of you that thinks, listen, I can't have a mostly remote workforce. I want to see them in those chairs. I want to see them working. That's what I'm used to seeing. Or how do you feel about the nature of measuring productivity?
The emotional impact or the emotional reaction, Evan, is that I'm used to a work environment where there are people walking around, talking, doing their jobs. So I like to see that. But if I tried to run a business based on emotion, it wouldn't go very well. We have to realize what's reasonable and can work for your business. We are not world innovators in technology, but one of our biggest employers in Rochester, when they went almost exclusively remote during the pandemic, was able to very effectively monitor all their employees based on keystroke and work output and everything else. Not only were their workers working remotely, but they were monitored remotely. So I don't have any objection to remote work as long as the work can get done. I think there are pros and cons of both, but if our people are going to work remotely, and some of them do, let's just get the job done, guys. And if we're doing that, I'm fine with it.
I mean, Patrick, your work situation is quite different, but how do you feel about this change that has really taken hold in the last decade or so?
My perspective is that it's industry specific.
Sure.
Somebody who's
working
in construction is working on site.
Yeah.
They're going from job site to job site. In my specific line of work in the office, when we are designing buildings, financing buildings, and creating a program for the future redevelopment of an entire city block, it really requires collaboration. This is not something where it's like, where's Jane? Is she coming in today? Are we going to be able to talk about this? So it's things that happen on the fly that are intuitively happening and we're designing in a way that is in a collaborative environment. And it wouldn't work well for us if we were all remote. An occasional remote day because, I can certainly support that and do support that, but it's just not as effective in my specific line of work. I really like going to the office because the vibe in the office is high energy, productive, and inspiring. I'm also very productive when I'm working at home. This morning I worked at home. I was extremely productive at home. It was great. Right? Knew that I was coming here today to see you all and appreciate the benefits of working at remote at times. It's just for certain lines of work, mine specifically, that is creative in nature, it makes it more difficult to be our best.
Yeah, I do wonder what the ceiling of percentage is eventually. I'm sure it'll continue to rise. To Patrick's point, of course, it is industry and line of work specific, and there will always be in-person work. It's just a question of where a lot of sectors that can go remote, will they do that? And I want to stress that as much as I was impressed with the Arthur C. Clarke clip from 1964, he wasn't right about everything. I mean, at one point he's like, there's going to be another form of intelligence, not just humans. And I was like, he's going to talk about AI. And he's like, apes. And I was like, okay, all right, well, I mean, we don't get everything here. So he's not right about everything, but he's warning that if this trend about work, which he was largely correct about, continues, it will remove the purpose of cities. And I don't know if that's exactly right, but I want to ask all of our guests about that. Let me start with Patrick on this. Clark is saying, without having to work in cities as hubs for jobs, the purpose of a metro won't exist as it has. And, you know, he saw a future of, you know, sprawling and sprawling and sprawling and ever sprawling suburbs, which seems quite hellish. And he didn't want to see that either. But I don't know that that's fully correct. How do you see right now what downtown, you know, how it functions now compared to maybe a decade ago? And if you were to look a generation out, what does it feel like a city's vibe is, its attraction is, its utility is?
Number one, it's really important to have strong suburbs. Okay, people are living in the suburbs. They're enjoying their time there. I think we need to think about, especially locally, how best to design better suburbs. Okay, so that's number one. So that's the suburbs aren't going to go away, and we need strong suburbs. As far as the city goes, Rochester specifically, one of the amazing things about this community is our institutions, and they, most of them, many of them, are located downtown. So our institutions, our jobs that are working at these institutions, and certain things like the riverfront and High Falls Future State Park. But you know, the Eastman Theater, the Memorial Art Gallery, the Strong Museum of Play. These are things that are attracting people from around the region and beyond, and they're not moving to the suburbs, right? The hotel districts, the convention centers. They're located downtown on the river, the Blue Cross Arena for events and ball games and things like that. There's cultural institutions that are creating a better community. And it's probably one of the reasons why Jen and her partner moved here, because not only is it a cool city with great institutions, but there's change of seasons and water and trees and other things that make Rochester really special. We need our downtown to be strong so that our suburbs can also be strong. Without a downtown core that is thriving in a creative way, then it feels far less valuable. But we have a lot of institutions that aren't going anywhere.
Okay. George, what do you make of that?
I take a more modest view of the importance of downtown. I think that downtowns really were much more meaningful when transportation, which would have been the canal, railroad, when those were really important. That's how downtowns founded, around transportation. Manufacturing hubs required goods to be transported in and transported back out as finished goods. We've seen a huge change in downtown over the last 40 years. I started my career in office downtown, and there was manufacturing down there, there was retail down there, there was office down there. A lot of that has hollowed out. Downtown has survived okay, but has changed a lot as the functions of work that I performed moved out to the suburbs, as did retail. But now it seems residential is moving to supplant that. I'm fine with it. I think it's great. The museums, the cultural institutions should be physically centrally located, so as easy to get to from Hilton, perhaps, as it would be from Penfield. But beyond that, I don't see huge importance to downtown itself, although I would agree with Patrick about the importance of the suburbs, because even though it doesn't get a lot of press, the fact is the majority of our population lives in the suburbs, presumably because that's where they like to live.
Yeah, I think part of, Patrick, correct me if I'm wrong, part of where Patrick is pointing out here is when you're going to have a strong museum of play, cultural institutions, art centers, et cetera, they're much more likely to be in population centers, which is currently cities. And that's the advantage for cities to continue surviving and thriving if they can, you know, sort of economically hang on through a transition at least partially away from the level of work in their physical spaces that they had. Is that part of what you're saying? There's a reason that the Strong Museum of Play is downtown. There's a reason that the cultural centers in Boston and New York City and Dallas are downtown or in cities, and not, you know, a 20-minute transit ride or a 45-minute car ride and 15 miles to the suburbs. So that this is the place that those institutions are. They're likely to stay here We've got to figure out how to reimagine some of the other aspects of cities, but you don't expect these institutions to travel away. Is that fair?
I don't.
No, that's absolutely fair.
Okay. And Patrick, yeah.
Really, you know, in addition to housing and other things that make up a community, like these cultural institutions are, like a community binds us together. And it's a huge advantage over suburban living where you have to be really intentional about connecting with your neighbors. You are, you know, maybe you're, if you're lucky, you're great friends with the people that live next door and across the street and you do things with them. That's a wonderful thing. It's great if you're able to walk somewhere from your suburban location to get a cup of coffee and meet a friend and have a meeting and take a class and do things that are community focused. That's a huge advantage that will always support the success and futures of cities is community building. And we'll always have that in front of us here. And it's one of the strengths of living and working and breathing and celebrating in a downtown way.
And I want to say to listeners, we're not trying to paint a catastrophic picture. This is a natural evolution that is going to be painful in a lot of places. It doesn't mean that a city like Rochester can't survive it. I mean, everyone's got to figure it out somehow. And the Rochester Downtown Development Corporation, other entities are tracking the state of office space. There are people in government. There's people in the private sector who are working on reimagining. In our second half hour, we'll talk about some of that, what that reimagined space might look like, some of the ideas that are out there. But I do want to key in on a point that CY emails. He says, Evan, if there's one thing Americans won't stand for, it's being told you don't have a choice. You must do it this way to participate. So CY is saying, you know, Governor Hochul can say all she wants. Well, people have to go back to work in cities. We got to get them back to work. We got too many empty offices. But what CY is saying, Jen, is the American worker has seen the future. They want it to be the present. And they're not going to be dragged back to an office if they don't have to. And they're going to fight that. You can't squeeze that toothpaste back into the bottle, essentially. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, well, and you can hear it in the language of these mandates. Return to office. Return doesn't evoke, you know, progress and innovation. It's going backward. We don't want to go backward. We should be trying to move forward. I mean, as horrible as the pandemic was, it created so much innovation. And I mean, like we talked about, cities used to be a central hub of transit, and that changed, and cities are still around, and they adapted, and they evolved. I think they're going to adapt and evolve again, which is really exciting, because now they're going to become probably something even that we can't envision right now, because it's going to be the new way to live and work. And there are even jobs that are remote now. People would be surprised are remote. Like, I got an eye exam from a remote optometrist who controlled the machine from her home.
I mean, that is close. And we are definitely moving in the direction of what Clark talked about with a surgeon on a different continent performing a surgery.
That's possible.
Yeah, that's probably possible right now.
It is.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons that this is all plausible. It's a question of how do you reimagine? So on that note, Barb says, let me pull up Barb's email. Barb says, make offices into housing. All this talk about not having enough housing, change these vacant office spaces into apartments, ones that can be purchased and others for renting, and that will bring foot traffic back into the cities. I'm going to let our guests all weigh in on that. Let me just say, Barb, I would, you know, in reading for this program, somewhere in my notes, here it is. So Georgetown University also looked at some of the data on this, and here's what they write about that. Quote, many cities are converting empty offices into housing. Do people moving into these converted urban spaces make up for the lost foot traffic and economic activity that offices spur? The simple answer is no. If you think of buildings as facilitating a density of people at that location in a city, there is no more efficient way to group people than in a commercial office building where the allocation of space per person can be as low as 150 square feet. Residential buildings will typically be 4 to 10 times less people dense than office buildings. So there is no way the conversion of office buildings into housing can support the same level of urban vitality compared to a fully occupied office building. End quote. Now, they go on to say, given the alternatives, housing is pretty good. I mean, it's not a bad idea in a lot of places. They also love the idea of mixed use, which we've heard a lot about. So definitely what Georgetown is saying is, don't just think housing perfectly solves this. just because of the density and the numbers. But it's a pretty good option if you don't have a ton of others and you don't expect to fill those offices with commerce. So, Patrick, how do you see this question? Because I know you're part of a lot of these discussions, and there has been some conversion to residential already in places like Rochester. There's talk of doing more. What do you think?
The trend is your friend. The trend is your friend. And the trend over in Rochester over the last 20-plus years is a conversion to mixed-use buildings. One thing that Rochester is interesting here post-COVID and reflecting on the history of Rochester and the evolution of office space in downtown Rochester specifically is that we've had a huge, huge head start on office vacancy. When Kodak, Xerox, and Bausch & Lomb all downsized roughly in the same general period, it was the first major flush out of vacancy in a downtown way. So we've been dealing with what to do with office space in a far earlier way than a lot of other cities that are now dealing with the post-COVID environment.
That is a really important point. It makes me both optimistic that we can handle it because we've been trying to innovate a little bit longer than some other cities. It makes me a little worried that I'm looking at Kodak across the street, Xerox, Bausch & Lomb. With those already kind of hollowed out, diminishing returns in future offices that get hollowed out in terms of what you can get for what you can do with residential, Patrick?
Well, all good things return to great design and beautiful architecture. That's something I've learned over and over again, is that there's something inherently beautiful about a loft in a vacant factory building. Designed well with beautiful windows and sunlight and natural materials, it's incredible. People seek this and pay a premium for it. And again, Rochester is flush with great buildings. And the ones that have been converted have typically been converted really, really well. And I think we'll continue to see that over the next 20 years.
We're next to the old Button Factory. They've got a great coffee shop downstairs. I love the space of it. I mean, I love sort of the feel of it. And it's been, but I mean, I would love to see more. So George Conboy, how do you feel about this move toward residential and then what these cities have to do with the puzzle of their downtown spaces? Hey, George.
Part of that
Hold on a sec, George. You were on mute for a second. It might have been us, might have been you. But regardless, go ahead.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
You can.
Okay. Good deal. Thank you. That's one of the problems of remote work is the technological challenge. But, I was part of that hollowing out of downtown. The large Wall Street firm I worked for closed their office back in the late 80s, and most of us scattered out to other locations. And at that time, virtually all brokerage firms were located downtown. When my firm, Brighton Securities, was founded in 1969, they told my predecessor, who was nuts, to have an office in the suburbs. But most of our employees, most of our colleagues lived in the suburbs and came downtown to work. I loved it. It was great, very vibrant. As that changed, offices moved to follow residential, which had largely moved to the suburbs. Now, that pendulum is a big pendulum, and swinging it takes a long time. And as we see people move into some of these downtown spaces, we may see office and retail follow them back. But that's a very long process. And the challenge you get with the downtown space, despite the wonderful design, a lot of great cultural amenities, I love to see it happen. But why do people move to the suburbs? Move to the suburbs because they want a yard for the kids to play in, to walk the dog. They want better schools than, unfortunately, our area is providing downtown right now. And the cost of private school, if you don't want to use the local school, is an obstacle, unfortunately. So it's going to be a struggle to get downtown as vibrant from pure residential just because of the physical factors of living in high-density urban space. It's a real struggle.
So let me flip that a little bit, George. You talk about what is possible. It's not certainly a definite, but it's possible that over time, as downtowns like Rochester convert some of the empty offices into more residential, we might see more population. Maybe naturally, the jobs and business flow back over time. What about the opposite? What about, you know, seeing what we see in Victor, in different places where you've got, you know, little tech hubs and things like that? Do you think it is plausible that we'll end up having smaller center cities and smaller downtowns, but then also, you know, maybe sort of mini booms, mini downtowns in outlying areas more often?
I don't see why not, Evan. When you look at the evolution of the family, with people staying single longer, maybe not having children, not having as many children, could my children's generation prefer urban space? I look at it, I think I prefer suburban space because I want space around me. But my opinion may become a minority opinion. It's entirely plausible. And if we have that good design and we have the amenities people want near where they live, and think of this morning's commute as something in favor of remote work, right? Well, Rochester's commute might average 15 or 20 minutes, but on a day like today, it averages half hour or an hour, and nobody likes that. So being closer to your hub of work, of retail, of friends, of culture, that pendulum could swing back down. Not going to happen tomorrow, but it certainly could happen.
I think the guest from Dallas is here to tell us that our traffic ain't so bad.
Oh, my God. When I hear people complain about traffic here, I'm like, you guys have no idea.
Well, I mean, I think Rochesterians, we secretly do, and Rochesterians love the idea that you can get anywhere in 20 minutes. 18 minutes or less is what generally people think. Patrick, do you think that there's any sort of a boom or mini boomlets that could happen in outlying areas, in suburbs, or are you still focused on downtown? You think futures are in downtowns?
Well, I'm hugely focused on downtown, but I also really like Rochester. And what I'd like for Rochester is more thoughtful planning of our suburbs. I think they do a very poor job, frankly, of planning in a way that creates a village center, right? There hasn't been a new village, for example, created in Rochester in a very long time. And I don't know how many villages or little mini centers that have been created over Dallas over the last 20 years, but I'd be willing to say that there's a number of them. I mean, I look at different growing communities and the way they plan their suburbs or even shopping, right? When they're planning a shopping center, nowadays they're planning a lot of residential around the shopping centers or a hospital that is partnered with a shopping center, which is adjacent to housing. It looks and feels more like a village. And that creates opportunities for community. I mean, that's the biggest thing that I think is really critical for our folks, our community to talk about and for town planners to discuss internally and with their community members is how do we promote community in a way where you can be in your home and never leave and get a job and have deliveries sent to your home. Like, you don't have to leave unless you really want to, but if there's things to do that are interesting and where you can have human connections, it's really important to be thoughtful with how you design it, how you plan it. And I think there's an opportunity for our towns to do better.
And is there a suburb that does stand? I mean, I'm thinking of maybe I Square and Irondequoit. I'm thinking of areas that are meant to be sort of mixed use, more walkable or accessible with multi-modes of transit, places where you can get a lot done, not just one task or one thing in any sort of afternoon or a day. I mean, is there anything that stands out to you, Patrick?
I think Fairport's done a really good job.
I was just out there yesterday morning. I couldn't believe what's
going on. Of taking advantage of vacant
stuff.
Buildings,
yeah.
Reprogramming those vacant buildings. And, you know, it's already strong community. It's a strong village on the canal. And I think they've done a really good job of taking advantage of their assets. But what these folks can also do is reexamine zoning. They can look at their zoning code that will open the doors for more placemaking endeavors from the development community.
Megan Mack, let's just bookmark Patrick's idea here. We ought to talk about what's happening in Fairport. There's a lot. I was out there for coffee yesterday. There was new housing, a ton of hive of activity on a rather cold day, and a lot of people on their feet. It's not like I've never been around a canal before, but I think a lot's happening. So that might be its own little story. I appreciate that point from Patrick. And for you, Jen, you know, again, if you're just joining us, Jen Long moved to Rochester about a year and a half ago from just outside Dallas, Texas. She is not a Rochesterian. She has no connections or family here. Chose here because she's a remote worker, been working remotely for 8 years. She works for Zoom. She has this opportunity to choose where she wants to work in the United States. She chose Rochester. First of all, it's a nice little endorsement. But what are some of the reasons? I mean, Patrick is talking about what he thinks, you know, draws people, what creates energy, what creates village-like feels. What were you looking for?
I was looking for similar mindsets, which has been really nice. I was looking for that community. Like, the festivals and events that happen here are insane. They are so cool. Things like that really don't happen in Dallas. I had never experienced something like that in my life. I also wanted seasons. It's so close to nature. Like, Finger Lakes is right there. There's so many parks in the city alone. It's close to the water. It's close to big hubs in other states that are nearby. And then there were the surprises, like traffic. When I put in the very first location that we went when we came to visit was we wanted to go get some food. We landed in the airport. We put in the location for K2, and I was like, oh, on the map, it looks like it's kind of far. And it was like 10 minutes to get there. And I was like, what? Seriously? And then everything else, it's like 4 minutes, 6 minutes. I'm like, what is happening? This is insane.
So you're used to seeing spatially on a map Dallas timing.
Right.
You've had to readjust to Rochester timing.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. There was another couple who moved to Rochester from Texas, started a restaurant here in the South Wedge. They told us living in Texas in the summer, it's like, imagine going to the surface of the sun and then turning the thermostat up another 5 degrees.
There's
not all that pleasant.
You cannot go outside. You just can't. Like, the fact, I have a friend who lives in Syracuse, and she's like, yeah, we're going to a summer bonfire. And I was like, a summer bonfire? Oh my God, that sounds horrible. And she's like, no, it gets cool at night, so we do a bonfire. I was like, cool at night. That's nice.
Summer is bonfire season here. That's like the total opposite of Texas. All right, so we're painting this picture here. But I do want to ask George and Patrick a separate question about what they want to see or what they think maybe local leaders can do about this. Because so much of the political discourse around this has been pretty one-dimensional. It's been governors, cities, Mayor Muriel Bowser in Washington, Governor Kathy Hochul. Before her, Andrew Cuomo said the same things. President Biden has said this. Now you have Vivek Ramaswamy. You've got others in the incoming Trump administration talking about, hey, cities are in trouble. You got to get people back to work. You got to make them go back to the office. That's a pretty one-dimensional conversation for a complex problem and a solution that may not work. But beyond that, George Conboy, what is the government's role in dealing with this problem? I know you prefer less hand on the wheel there. What do you think can be done to deal with a growing problem in urban centers with empty office space?
I'm not sure it's a problem for me. I'm not sure it's a problem for my workforce. The lighter hand on the wheel that you refer to, and you are absolutely correct in my opinion, is that I don't need or want a governor or mayor or any other politician to tell me and my workforce where we should live and work. I'm happy. I'm an old school guy. I love having everybody in the office collaborating, great teamwork, mentorship. It's fine. But the fact is that when good employees need or want to work elsewhere, and for our business, it works well for us, we're happy to say, super. It's not my responsibility to fill a vacant building to satisfy somebody's need for tax revenue or anything else. So I understand the desire to have vibrant cities, so please go fill up the office buildings. I understand why they say that, but it in no way has any impact on any decision-making that our firm or our employees would make.
George, is it fair to say that you're concerned that, you know, more government hand on the wheel will drive inorganic solutions that maybe won't last very long? We're literally sitting here in High Falls, which I'm always amazed that there's not more here. I love this part of the city. The bridge is going to reopen. It's one of my favorite places. The brewery's right across. I love just the wonderfully walkable feel to it. But the reality is that 20 years ago in the Bill Johnson administration, long before Jen Long was here, they tried to make an entertainment district down here. And, you know, the city got involved. They offered some pretty heavy incentives. And most of those businesses didn't succeed. They were not able to drive people here. So go ahead, George.
They poured a fortune into that development, mostly in the Johnson administration, with all the best of intentions.
Sure.
And at the same time, they poured a fortune into a bunch of failed projects. The East End developed largely without any governmental intervention or support, and remains today a popular, if somewhat less popular than a while ago, nightlife spot. So I would prefer not to be taxed to provide incentives to projects that get decided from angles that don't necessarily meet what the market, and by market I mean people, really want. Stick to plowing the roads, collecting the garbage, make sure the water runs through the pipes, preferably with no dead guys in the reservoir, and I'd be fine with that.
Patrick, as a developer, you know, you've had to work with a number of local leaders. What do you think the role of local government has to be in this, and how do you see maybe what the right decision-making matrix is? Because you're going to have a lot of people with a lot of ideas here.
As far as remote work goes, I don't see any reason why the mayoral, why City Hall should be involved in dictating what private organizations do. There's no room for it, and it sounds absurd to actually say it out loud. And again, thinking about just the market in general, like some folks thrive working at home. Some folks thrive working in the office. If certain organizations or industries, like I was speaking to an advertising executive recently, and it's collaborative, it's creative. They need their people around them. So, and if the people don't want to be in that environment and they really are seeking something from home, then they can seek an alternative industry that's outside of maybe advertising, okay? Maybe certain days it works well for the advertising company and their leadership because they need to lead that ship in the right direction. They got to secure clients and they need to perform for their clients. If they're not performing because they can't have the collaborative approach that's required and being remote is an obstacle for that, then they have the ability to dictate to their employees to come to the office. And if employees don't want to, then they'll hire somebody else. That same executive told me that they said, Patrick, what's amazing is that some of these young folks that come into the office, you know, because they want to, you know, not because we're making them right now, we want them to come back, but not because we're making them, they have all the room for advancement. They are around the leaderships. They are learning from us, like in a way that the remote worker is not. I'm going to choose this person because I have trust and they're here for advancement. I don't know how that works in a remote world. You know, it's, you know, I don't, Jen knows better than I, for sure. How you advance in a way that is recognized and appreciated when you're not seen as much. I'm sure it happens all the time. I just don't know.
What do you think, Jen?
Well, I'm lucky to have an absolutely amazing manager, and a lot of it is due to he's very good about getting members of our team front and center in front of the executives and showing what we're working on so that our names are out there, our projects are seen, and we actually have a lot. It's a very flat organizational structure, so we do a lot of talking with the executives of our department to make sure that they're in the know. If they have questions, we can answer them. But we do all sorts of collaborating remote. Our web design team is on my team, the web team, and they make beautiful page designs and creative projects. We use Zoom as a whiteboard tool. We'll use that to brainstorm. I think we're in the mindset where what you would typically do in an office, like, oh, I need to go by so-and-so's desk to talk about this. We just innately will either like send them a quick chat message or say, hey, can we just hop on a call? I had this idea and I wanted to run it by you. And boom, we're collaborating. We're remote. Our designers are in Colorado. My boss is in San Jose. I work with developers in India. Like, I'm able to work with all these people just from my humble spot in Rochester.
And you chose, by the way, not only to live in the city, but closer to downtown, right?
Yeah.
For a reason?
It's close to a lot of the businesses and restaurants that me and my friends like to go to. And it means, I mean, in the summertime, it's great. I can hop on one of those scooters and just buzz back home really easy after going out to the bar. It's closer to the festivals. People will come and like park in our driveway so that we can just go on over to downtown or the South Wedge, and so it makes it nice. I have friends that wish they could have gotten a house close to the city but had to go to the suburbs.
Let me ask Patrick one more question. I'm going to rip through as many of your emails as I can get through here in our remaining time. Are you, as a developer, is this a big-time worrying time for you? Are you an optimist? And I'm not mean like in sort of this Pollyanna way. I mean, realistically, has the nature of your work changed significantly? You may have ideas or possible partners or collaborations But you also may have power brokers saying, look, we can't do anything new. We've got a bunch of empty office space to begin with here. Like, we got to redesign. Like, we're in real trouble here. How do you see the nature of your work, and are you an optimist about it going forward?
I'm an optimist for downtown Rochester because I think it's a fabulous collection of buildings and community amenities that are surrounding it that I previously mentioned. I think the future is bright, but it takes deliberate decision-making and planning in a really big way between your civic and private partners, okay? So, but we're designing. It's not like I'm taking a vacant building and saying, oh, this should be a new office building. I'm taking vacant buildings and saying, how many residential units shall I place in this building? What is the size? What is the makeup? What is going to be on the ground floor of my building? How is that ground floor going to interact with the community and neighbors around this particular block? And is there an opportunity for some level of office space, and who might that be? Okay, so I'm asking those questions, and but all the while designing great residential units for people who work at home, right? That's the other thing. Like, the trend is a friend here too. It's not like remote work is just going to go away. Regardless of what anybody says at the federal or state level, it's a trend that is going to continue. We're going to get better at working from home. And if I'm not designing spaces to accommodate work from home folks with great rooftops and great lobby spaces that look like a co-working cafe, then I'm failing my future residents. So that's what we're doing.
Big nods from Jen here. Jen is saying you're onto something, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, the benefits to me of being in person is going to a conference and meeting people in my industry, or like connecting with people in the marketing industry in the area. I like going out to like a drinks event. That's fun, and that's also outside of my working hours, and I can be productive in a different way and network. And I think those spaces are perfect for that, because if you're creating something, a reason to leave the house to go and meet in person, that's a great way to do it.
Any projects that stand out that you're most excited about, Patrick?
There's an old department store downtown called the Edwards Building. It was very prominent in our community for generations. It's been now vacant for up almost 20 years, formerly occupied by Excellus, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and Xerox. And we've been working hard to get this off the ground. It's in a very delicate neighborhood that is on the rise, but we're still a little bit early. But meanwhile, we've been planning it for the better part of 10 years. We've got a lot of approvals. We have a lot of grants that are supporting the project, historic tax credits, because it's a historic building listed on the National Register of Historic Places. But we're designing really, really great apartments that are rich with community amenities, like I mentioned, like rooftop, a rooftop pool, for heaven's sakes, a rooftop community space, and a rooftop fitness space that has a private yoga studio up there, a ground floor lobby that feels like a hotel in New York City, with co-working space off to the side where folks can take meetings. And what that leads to is somebody leasing an apartment, they say to themselves, oh my God, this is a really great apartment. It's a beautiful historic building, huge windows. Like, I love it. I love what you guys have done with it. And then they say to themselves, where am I going to take my calls today? Should I go upstairs in the community space? It's so nice outside. I should go outside and sit on the deck, rooftop deck. Or I'm going to meet somebody in the lobby, and we're going to grab a coffee, and we're going to rent one of those private rooms and just take a conference in person. So I think it's our duty as redevelopers of our community to think prudently about who we're hosting.
Let's talk about that as it gets closer to launch. Appreciate that. Another listener says, I live in a village and can walk to retail and restaurants, the post office, the bank, church, the library, even have a small park. It's the best of both worlds, residential with many amenities in walking distance. Jane says, I've heard that some law firms will still allow their employees to work from home, but if they want to keep their private office, they have to be in their office at least 3 days a week. Surprising how much having your own office can incentivize coming back to work in a tall building. David says, for obvious reasons, during my academic career as a scientist with a lab full of students, on most days I very definitely needed to be in my office and lab. These days, heading a nonprofit, I do essentially all of my work from home. It certainly is convenient, but I do miss the social life that working with others in person so very definitely provided to me. And Mark just wants to know, how do you know if an employee is not being productive? So again, that question just keeps coming up here. George Conboy, 30 seconds. Do you feel like if your workforce got even a little bit more remote, that you'd have a handle on productivity?
No, I think we have a pretty good handle on productivity now. And even with more remote, I think we would still have a handle on productivity. Work output is necessary. And if we see it decline, well, we'll deal with that as we need to. But so far, we have not had those problems with remote work, and that's 20 seconds.
That is 20 seconds. That's why George is so good at this. Jen, have you had coworkers who you've wondered, like, hey, I don't think they're pulling their weight? Or is that few and far between in the remote work world?
I've had it in remote work. I've also had it in person. Like, I've definitely experienced it in both. It's not the location you're working. It's the people. Like, it will be evident whether they're in the office or not if they're actually working.
That's actually, it should be an obvious point, but it's a really important one. We talk about remote work, and we're like, well, what are you going to do with people who aren't pulling their weight? Well, that's never happened in person before, right? So it's a brand new problem.
Right.
I just want to thank our guests for taking the time to talk about these issues with us this hour. Jen Long is the reason she reached out a few months ago, telling your story, coming to Rochester from Dallas. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Pretty cool that you're here. Isn't it cool?
I love it.
Senior Content SEO Manager at Zoom. Patrick Dutton, downtown developer, real estate broker with Fortified and Dutton Properties. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And George Conboy, calling in remotely, chairman of Brighton Securities. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Evan.
Great conversation. More coming up right here on Connections.